The Blaze Radio Network. On demand. Freedom's Disciple on demand.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
So honored and privileged to speak to one of the most respected, most well-spoken people in the conservative movement. He is right up there with Glenn Beck for me, the one and only Ben Shapiro. Thank you so much for joining us, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So I want to talk to you about something different. You spend a lot of time. I'm a big fan of your podcast. As you say, it's the quickest growing and most growing conservative podcast out there. You spend a lot of time focusing in on the issues of the day. But what I do on this show is I talk about principles. So I actually would like to start with you about American history. Because for me, not enough people talk about American history and truly understand why it's exceptional. So for you, why is America exceptional to you? Why is it an exceptional nation?
America is an exceptional nation because of our founding principles. So all the talk about how powerful we are, how much we've helped other nations, all of that is a secondary effect of the fact that we are founded on a basic idea that human beings are created with God-given rights that are inalienable, and that a limited government is created by those people through a policy of consent in order to protect those rights. And if those rights are ever violated by the government loses its basic legitimacy. That concept has been the foundation for the entire edifice that is the United States. And that foundation has also taken into account the fact that human beings were made free so that they could be virtuous. So it was the idea of a social fabric that promoted virtue combined with governmental freedom that allowed the flourishing of free markets, private property, communities, and the strongest country in the history of the world.
Absolutely. And I think you hit on something there, because the idea of pursuing your own happiness and being able to keep the fruits of your own labor and to keep your private property. How can people, and I don't mean this in a left-right point of view or a Republican-conservative point of view, I mean, how can we explain to people today who are like, you know what, Norwegian-style socialism it's okay. How can we explain it in such a way as someone who lives in Ireland, I do this an awful lot, but how can we reach young people and say, that is not the way forward, that this idea that you can control your own destiny, and if you make it, you get to enjoy those fruits?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thing to remember is that in a free country, things are harder very often. A free country is about the idea that you're going to rise or fall based on your own will, your own labor, your own ideas. And that's risky. It's a lot riskier than the idea that you're living in a social welfare state that's going to protect you against the vicissitudes of life. But it also means there's a lot more upside. And that's always been the truth in the United States, which is why it's the most powerful economy in the history of the world by an extraordinary margin, because the United States bargain was always that the most creative people, the people who are risk seekers, were going to come here and then were going to seek risk. They were going to take those risks in order to make their lives better. They were going to forge out on their own. That's sort of the American spirit people talk about. You can have a system that lasts for a certain amount of time in which capitalism is the defining feature of an economy, but a bunch of socialist infrastructure is piled on top of it. Today on my show, I sort of compared it to a clown on stilts, the stilts being capitalism, the clown being the socialist programs on top of it. That can last for a certain amount of time. It can't last indefinitely. And if you make the clown too heavy, then the stilts crumble. So if you like what Norway looks like, you have to recognize that Norway is basing that on exorbitantly high taxes, an enormous oil slush fund, and a declining amount of social capital as fewer and fewer people are in the workforce and as the work ethic that made Norway prosperous in the first place is being undermined by the social welfare ethic that Norway is promoting. It's easy to look at places as sort of a moment in time. The question is, how durable is that system? How long can it last in the absence of growth, in the absence of risk seeking, and in the absence of the protection of private property and the profit motive?
Absolutely. And if you look at the idea of America, you know, one of the frustrating things for me is I say this time and time again. I say, pick any part of society and don't let me influence you, you know, whether it's travel, whether it's communication, whether it's food, whether it's medicine, any part. And look at the advancements from the time of Christ to 1800s and then from 1800 to 2018. Why have we advanced so much in 218 years compared to the prior 1800 years? I would say, and I argue, that's a large chunk because of America, because that idea comes first. Would you agree?
No question. I mean, if you look at what made the world prosperous, it is this idea of free markets and private property combined with a limited government that is there to protect those things. I will say that I think that there also has to be that element of social fabric and virtue that is a holdover from a Judeo-Christian era. And one of the big problems with sort of the Enlightenment, the benefit of the Enlightenment is the idea that human beings are rational actors who ought to be free to pursue their economic interest and who ought to be free from government compulsion in matters of the heart and matters of religion. You know, that's the good side of the Enlightenment. The bad side of the Enlightenment is that sometimes people use that as an excuse to forget about the cultivation of virtue. And without a virtuous citizenry, freedom ends up kind of decaying into libertinism or alternatively into a belief that you can use your reason to restructure society in radical ways. And that's been sort of the legacy of the 19th and 20th centuries. Virtuous populations that are left free end up becoming incredibly prosperous and drive the prosperity of the entire world. Non-virtuous populations that are left free end up in social decay, and populations that are not left free end up in gulags.
Awesome. So let's fast forward to sort of more modern day questions. I have a question for you because you've studied law, and I would just love to give you a scenario of what I would have done and just tell me why this wouldn't work or what the problems are. Do you remember the whole Obamacare debate? And it goes before the Supreme Court.
Of course.
I'm the lawyer, God help America if I'm the lawyer, but I love your Constitution and I've studied it. I go and I present one piece of evidence. Your Honor, the piece of evidence is Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. If you find health care in any of those 18 clauses, we can come back and talk. I rest my case. Why doesn't that work? Or how can
I mean, the only reason that it should work, but the only reason it doesn't is because constitutional interpretation in the United States has had very little to do with the Constitution for several decades here. We've now read rights into the Constitution that don't exist, duties into the Constitution that do not exist. And that's a serious problem. The government was never meant to be this large. It was a government of enumerated powers. We far exceeded those enumerated powers. And unfortunately, the checks and balances system that was supposed to reign in government has failed in a lot of ways. The founders is interesting. The founders basically bet that the biggest problem facing America was going to be ambitious politicians grabbing power. And it turns out that one of the biggest problems facing America is not ambitious politicians grabbing power, but a group of politicians who are willing to allow others to grab power so long as they keep getting elected to their kind of cush positions. And so what you've seen in the United States in terms of how our government structure works is that Congress has almost become a vestigial organ of government, providing some checks to the executive, but the executive is by far the most active part of the American government. And even when Congress does pass a law, they tend to pass these very long omnibus packages that nobody's ever read, and then it's up to the executive to implement.
Okay, so how do we get back to, or sorry, not we, I can't say, I'm not an American. How do you get back to the future, to going back to the Constitution, especially with regards to the Supreme Court, to getting back to, if it's not in Article 1, Section 8, if it's not in Section 2, Article 2, Paragraph for the Presidency, it's just automatically unconstitutional. It doesn't matter whether it's the most moral principle or the most, you know, with the best intentions, it violates the Constitution. What can people do to get to that point? Or as America just totally gone past it?
I think that the only thing that we can do is point to the fact that partisanship is so high and that we all hate our politicians and say, wouldn't it be better if these people didn't matter? And this is one of the, I think, main points that I wish the left would take from the Trump presidency is, if you really dislike President Trump, if you're really scared of President Trump, if you hated George W. Bush and you were scared of George W. Bush, and I dislike Barack Obama and I was scared of some of the stuff Obama was doing, if all of that is the case, then maybe the problem isn't whoever is in power alone. Maybe the problem is that the government has centralized this much power in the first place, and we'd all be better off leaving each other alone.
Absolutely. And you've made actually one point, and I listen to as much radio and I read radio, but over the last week or so, you've made a point a couple of times in your show, and I'd love you to expand upon it, because it's really important and it's really critical. The founders kind of wanted presidents to be impeached. There's this idea, yeah, when I talk to people today, it's like, oh, you can't impeach president. And it's not even, forget Trump. This is not about Donald Trump. This is just general. You can't impeach a president. It's the worst thing going. You're one of the only people, the only person I've heard, but I'm sure there are a few others who've raised this. Would you expand upon that? Why the founders set that up?
So the founders set up impeachment as the only check on the presidency. There's no ability to really criminally prosecute the president of the United States. And that means that when the president actually violates the law, they were expecting that people were going to be pretty robust in their attempt to oust the president. The party system basically overthrew all of that, where members of a particular party had more loyalty to the person in power than to the institution of the legislature. But there's some pretty, you know, hot and heavy debate in the Constitutional Convention about how often impeachment was to be used, what was the standard to be for impeachment. And what they came up with when they said high crimes and misdemeanors is something that goes so much to the nature of the office that the person has to be impeached. But then over the course of time, it's been used, you know, a very, very minute amount. And when it is used, it generally fails. It's become a political tool. I think the founders originally wanted it to be instead a tool of checks and balances between the branches. So, you know, in my opinion, I think a lot more presidents, not fewer presidents, should probably have been impeached over time. But that said, you know, because it is a political tool and because it has a political definition, the chances that, for example, Obama was ever going to be impeached by a Democratic Congress were already incredibly low. The chances that Trump will ever be impeached by a Republican Congress are really low, which means that this all just becomes part of the woodwork. And the safest thing for Congress to do at this point is just wait for the next election cycle.
Perfect. So moving on to another issue, and it's an issue that annoys me with conservatives the most, immigration reform. So I'm an Irishman. I've waited. I don't know. I'm sure you don't know who I am, but I've waited in line 14 years to get into your country. Last year, I had a job offer from Glenbeck, went through the visa process, and basically we found out because I don't have a college degree and because I don't have work experience doing what exactly research for him, I couldn't get it. My biggest frustration, and I've spoken to people on the Hill, I've given this. Remember when Obama had the illegal immigrant at the State of the Union? I would have had a conservative guest say, here's someone who waited in line 10 years. Even this is not about me, by the way. This is just in general. Here's someone who waited in line 10 years, paid $10,000 to get the American dream, and they've been successful. Why do conservatives never, ever highlight there's about 3.5 million people, according to Heritage, waiting in line? We never get a mention. Illegal immigrants, yep. They're dreamers, they are acting noble. This is from conservatives. They acted out of love from Jeb Bush, they're there to pick lettuce. People like me who want to do things the right way, who love your nation, never mentioned. On conservative media, don't talk about MSNBC, conservative media. What can we do to change that?
You know, I think that this actually highlights a pretty significant debate that's been going on inside the Republican Party with regard to legal immigration. And that's the part that people don't actually want to talk about. There are some members of the Republican Party who are actually very much against legal immigration in general, because they suggest that this is going to undercut the domestic labor force if we bring in people who are legal immigrants who want to join the country. I've never been of that opinion. I think that's the battle that has to be fought first and foremost. And then, you know, saying that folks should go to the back of the line if they're illegal immigrants, I think that's pretty obvious. I think that if you came into the country illegally, you didn't follow our rules, then you going to the back of the line makes perfect sense. But, you know, the problem is that I think that there's a feeling that there's a cynical move being made by some members of the Republican Party to say illegal immigrants go to the back of the line, but really we don't want anyone in. And I think that you have to make a stark and loud distinction between legal immigrants and illegal immigrants. The fact that people on the right have failed to do that, or at least some people on the right have failed to do that, I think is a big mistake.
Absolutely. And the other big of my frustration, and this includes President Trump, because he was out all last week talking about, you know, the immigration system is broken, we need new laws. I'm of the opinion you don't need any new laws. You actually don't need immigration reform. What you actually need to do is actually enforce the immigration laws on your books, because you've got clear laws with regards to visas. Now, you may not like the quotas or you may not like the things. Then you might want to change them. But you don't need new laws to solve illegal immigration. You know, you have all the laws. If I go over as a visitor, which I do regularly, I have 90 days. If I'm not out 90 days, I know I can be fined, put in jail, and deported. And I also know that I can be stopped access, granted access to America for 10 years. I signed that waiver on a computer now when I go to fly into your country. So you have all the laws on the books. How can we get that message out there?
The problem is that the issue has been demagogued so much that when you say enforce the laws on the books, everybody on the left immediately says, what, you mean deport 12 million people? And the answer is, well, no, because nobody actually wants to enforce the laws on the books. This is the great lie about immigration. You know, we can enforce the laws on the books, and I think we should accelerate the acceptance of people who are coming across the border illegally. But the truth is, Republican, Democrat, nobody actually wants to enforce the laws on the books with regard to illegal immigration. President Trump doesn't want to, right? Nobody actually wants to, and that's why they talk about restructuring of law. But the truth is, you can't restructure the law until we actually have a basic agreement on what we want to do with all of these folks. It's always seemed to me that first priority would be ensuring that legal immigrants get into the country legally, that we deport all criminals, and that we then move toward deporting people or at least making them wait in line for citizenship. And we do a when it comes to illegal immigration, I think that they should have to go through the same rigorous process that legal immigrants go through in terms of, do we actually want you in the country or not? And you don't get a leg up just because you're in the country. If you're in the country, you have exactly the same standards as my wife did when she immigrated to America. And if you don't fulfill those standards, you don't get to stay.
Awesome. So then just looking forward to the future. So we're in a culture right now where we are buying, so many people are buying this argument. I know you don't. This lesser of two evils. America was never founded on that lesser of two evils. If they bought that, they would have might said, you know what, let's just get rid of Hutchinson, in the mayor of Boston. That's our compromise. They went and they 56 of them put their life and their name on a death warrant for an idea. How do we get past, I'm not saying people should sign a death warrant and, you know, sign a new Declaration of Independence or any type of revolution like that, but how do we get to a point where we stop this lesser of two evils, but also that we start talking principles once again?
You know, I think that it's going to require some effort on both sides. So first of all, it's going to require for the left to actually stop suggesting that everyone they disagree with is a Nazi. The longer they do that, the more we start saying, okay, you're calling me a Nazi, you're now threatening my in-group, and that justifies me doing pretty much anything to stop you. So the left needs to stop with that nonsense. And then the right needs to stop suggesting that people who disagree with us or who dislike President Trump, that they are all traitors with malintent who want to destroy the country. But I'm not sure any of this is going to happen until we actually have a return to certain basic ideas of what the country ought to be. Right now, the biggest problem that we have is that a huge number of Americans don't actually understand what made America great in the first place, to bring this full circle. And if you don't understand what made America great in the first place, we don't actually have a basic agreement on what we want America to look like. There was a basic idea in the 1950s that we all sort of wanted the same things. We wanted to raise our kids without being bothered by the government. We wanted to be free to own our own property. We wanted to have a thriving economy. And then there were arguments on the margins about what top tax rates should be, what government programs should look like. Instead, right now, it looks like one side wants to transform the country. I mean, this is what Barack Obama said. And the other side wants to make America great again. And that's a pretty significant difference in mind. Until that can be crossed, that's going to be a continuing problem, this lesser of two evils issue. And that begins with acknowledging that folks on the other side, particularly folks on the left, are going to have to acknowledge this of people on the right, that folks on the right are not just evil pieces of garbage with bad intent who hate black people and gay people and poor people. If they keep saying that, then folks on the right are going to predictably respond saying, you're my enemy and whatever I need to do to stop you is justified.
So how does people, you know, what would your advice be to the average person out there that really loves America, you know, that wants to change it, understands the real meaning of America? What would your advice be to them if you could say, here, I would do this if I were you. This is what I would invest my time in.
I mean, live a virtuous life and talk to your neighbors. I mean, frankly, if everybody lived a virtuous life and talked to their neighbors, I think that would solve 90% of our problems. But it seems like we've taken all of our anger and all of our frustration, we've poured it into politics instead of pouring it into good works and demonstrating to our neighbors that we're trustworthy and that we can all live together. The reason that people feel a necessity for government is because they want to force somebody else to do something. If people are generally seeing each other as brothers as opposed to enemies, that's going to radically change how even the nature of government is done.
Okay, awesome. So just to finish up, we've got a couple of quick questions for you. They're yes or no or very simple questions. For me, two questions. One, your favorite founding father and why?
Well, growing up, it was always John Adams because I had watched 1776 and grew up on it. Now, you know, I think there's I do love a lot of the writings of Thomas Jefferson. It's hard not to say George Washington, because George Washington legitimately is a heroic figure. But there are a lot of fantastic founding fathers. James Madison is a very underrated founding father. There are a bunch who are just terrific.
I agree. Actually, just on a side point, this wasn't one of my questions planned. I'm actually working on something to make an argument that George Washington was your best ever president. Just on the basis of that, would you say that's ludicrous or not?
No. I think there's a very good argument. I think that the only person who would possibly be up there aside from Washington is Lincoln. And I think there's a solid case to be made that Washington was a better president than Lincoln.
Okay. Second one, favorite amendment and why?
My favorite amendment is still, it's hard for me to cut against. That's a tough one. I'd have to go. It's between 1st, 2nd, and 14th.
Okay.
The Equal Protection Clause is obviously deeply, deeply important. The First Amendment is the protection of religion and free association and freedom of speech is the closest to my heart in terms of most fundamental human rights. And the Second Amendment has to be up there because I think that in the absence of the Second Amendment, you don't get the 14th or the First.
Amen. So these are just general questions from people. I put it out on Twitter. What's your favorite nonfiction book?
My favorite nonfiction book. Let's see. Wow, I have like an entire list. The one I always recommend in terms of what people should read is Economics in One Lesson, which is a really short kind of primer on economics by Henry Hazlitt. But there are a bunch of, my goodness. I'd say the Bible.
That's not fiction.
But, but it depends on your classification. The Federalist Papers I love. Anything by Paul Johnson is great. Anything by Thomas Sowell is great. I have every day on my show I do a thing I like, so that list is now probably hundreds of books long. Yeah, that's a tough one. I'll have to think about that one a little more.
Yeah, and your things you're like, how, just on a personal question, you've recommended a load of TV shows. How do you get time? Like last week you recommended Billions, the Serial Killer. I'm like, where do you get the time?
Well, I mean, once you have small kids, what you realize is that escaping from your small children to watch TV for 10 minutes on the toilet is basically the only time that you have to enjoy your life. So, that, and then also my wife gets home and we put the kids to bed and then we have no energy and we just sack out on the couch and watch TV. So, even for us, that's
actually a great segue to my next question. Someone said, what does your wife do for a living? I got that so many times. I'm like, if you don't know, there's not many times.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody is asking facetiously. Yes, my wife is indeed a doctor.
Absolutely. Then last one, I don't know why this is interesting. What's your favorite pizza toppings?
My pizza toppings are pretty limited because the pizza toppings cannot encompass meat for me. So I do like I like peppers. I like onions. And let's see, what else? Not pineapple. No. But no, that's terrible.
Awesome. So last question I always ask anyone who comes on this show. Why is America exceptional in one sentence? Or why is it great? And if you can give it in one sentence to everyone that you could share with everyone.
America is exceptional because of the principles upon which it was founded. If you don't understand those principles, you're doing a great disservice to not only the founding fathers, but to the country that is worth upholding and to the people who have died to protect those freedoms that you get to live under.
Amen. And where can people find your podcast?
You can go check it out at SoundCloud, iTunes, basically any podcast app will have it. It's the top rated conservative podcast in the country.
Absolutely, and the dailywire.com, giving out the, what's that, the Tumblr with?
The leftist steers hot or cold, yeah, the leftist steers hot or cold Tumblr with the annual subscriptions. Yeah, it doesn't say liberal, it says leftist, there's a difference.
There is a big difference. Ben, listen, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute honor. Keep doing I'm not just saying this to you, you're one of the few people as an Irishman who looks over to the country I love so much, and I sit looking at people who get it, with the exception of you and Glenn, and a couple of other people, let's put it this way, I can count on my left hand to truly get America and who have remained consistent. You're in our prayers, you're in my prayers, because now is the time. Your country is in peril. I see you going towards socialism, and it needs to stop, because even though I may never get to be an American, that if you're not that beacon of hope, the rest of the world is living in tyranny, and you're seeing that around the world. So please keep being a voice, and I'll do all we can to support you. And thank you so much for your time today. I know you're so busy.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
This is Freedom's Disciple with Jonathan Dunn on the Blaze Radio Network.